Hello, I'm Laura Castleton, U.S. Head of Portfolio Construction and Strategy at Janus Henderson Investors. For 90 years, we've worked to help clients achieve superior financial outcomes and fulfill our purpose of investing in a brighter future together. To learn more, go to janushenderson.com.
UK conservatives are punished at the polls. Plus, we'll crunch the numbers from Apple's earnings and survey the rapid end to work from home.
Meta comes to mind, a pioneer in remote work. They've recently frozen new applications for remote work. And when Meta says we're not so into the remote work anymore, I think that really sends a signal of where we're headed.
It's Friday, May 5th. I'm Luke Vargas with The Wall Street Journal. And here is the AM edition of What's News, the top headlines and business stories moving your world today. We begin in the UK, where the ruling Conservative Party has been dealt a major political setback in local elections. Results are still trickling in this morning, and while Prime Minister Rishi Sunak was not on the ballot, our correspondent Max Colchester told me that the vote suggests he could face an uphill battle ahead of the UK's next general election.
So this is a galling result for Sunak, who has essentially, since coming to power last fall, has tried to steady the ship after a fairly chaotic year for the Conservative Party, which saw both former Prime Ministers Boris Johnson and Liz Truss ousted by its own members. He's tried to tackle the core issue of the day, which is an economic one, which is how to get a grip on rampant inflation in the UK, which is really hitting a lot of traditional Conservative voters in the pocket very hard, while dealing with a number of issues such as illegal immigration and huge waiting lists for nationalised healthcare here. But the vote today will show that there is real anger against the Tory party, who are seeking a record fourth term in office since they were first elected 13 years ago in 2010, and no other political party in British history has ever achieved such a feat, let alone during a steep economic downturn.
All right, so lots at stake in the next general election, though we don't know when that's actually going to be, right?
No, we don't. It has to happen at the latest by January 2025, but it's really in the gift of the ruling Conservative Party as to when it wants to call that election. And it's estimated that Sunak will want to wait as long as possible to try and see that inflation come down and see something of an economic tick up before calling a poll.
Meanwhile, markets are digesting earnings from tech giant Apple, which rounded off two busy weeks of financial updates from the tech sector. As we reported on What's News last night, Apple saw a drop in sales for the second consecutive quarter amid waning demand for Macs and iPads. Though, as Journal Markets reporter Caitlin McCabe explains, the iPhone maker benefited from sales in emerging markets.
So a lot of the growth for Apple and its iPhone business actually came from emerging markets, places like India and Latin America and the Middle East. And the India story is a really interesting one. The United Nations said earlier this year that India will overtake China as the world's most populous country later this year. And so we're really seeing Apple focused on that market specifically. The company opened its first retail store in India last month, and it's also looking to the country as a potential major location for diversifying its supply chain away from China. And so India came up several times yesterday during earnings. Tim Cook told analysts that India has a lot of people entering the middle class and that they're hoping they can convince them to buy iPhones.
And Caitlin says the success of that strategy will be key to Apple's future performance.
The iPhone is really core to Apple's business. And the good news for investors or virtually anyone with a retirement account these days is that Apple's iPhone sales rose about 2% year over year, which beat analyst expectations. Demand for Pro models, so it's more expensive models, are still going strong. We had an interesting stat in one of our stories last night about the average selling price of the iPhone is $988 in the January through March period. So it really just shows us that consumers are still willing to spend on this very core product, and they're willing to pay the premium prices for it.
In other news this morning, police in Serbia have arrested a suspect in the country's second mass shooting this week. 8 people were killed and 14 wounded in yesterday's shooting, which came just a day after a 13-year-old boy used his father's gun to kill 8 fellow students in the capital, Belgrade. In response, Serbian authorities are boosting a variety of gun control measures. Wednesday's school shooting was the first in the country's modern history. We are reporting that President Biden has made his choice for the Pentagon's top officer. According to U.S. officials, Biden is expected to nominate Air Force General Charles Brown to take over as the next chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. If nominated and confirmed by the Senate, Brown would assume the post held by Army General Mark Milley in September, and in the process become the second black general to hold the role. As chairman, Brown would inherit a Pentagon that's attempting to focus on competition with China, even as it's steeped in the war in Ukraine. The U.S. military is also lagging behind in shipbuilding and hypersonic technology, while a tight labor market has caused recruitment challenges for some military services. And the biggest IPO of 2023 is providing a strong dose of market relief. Johnson & Johnson's spun-off consumer healthcare business Kenvue opened trading Thursday, selling more shares than planned and finishing the day 22% over its list price. Despite Kenvue's debut, the U.S. IPO market remains quiet by historical standards, though analysts are counting on potential listings from British chip designer Arm and grocery delivery company Instacart to fuel a pickup in activity later this year. Coming up, flexible work arrangements are quickly becoming a thing of the past. With U.S. jobs data due out today, we'll dig into a trend lurking just below the numbers as the not-so-gradual end to work from home reorders life for workers and the culture at the office. That's after the break.
Enter a revolutionary business world where AI meets power with Intel Core Ultra and Intel vPro. Imagine PCs that boost productivity, creativity, and collaboration with cutting-edge AI. They're gateways to innovation, engineered with powerful AI performance, hardware-based security, and AI-powered threat detection. Plus, they're built sustainably and can be managed remotely. Transform your workflow with Intel Core Ultra and Intel vPro today. No product can be absolutely secure. Become an IT hero at intel.com/ITheroes.
Today is Jobs Friday. In just a few hours, we'll get official data on U.S. employment, which will shed light on which sectors are growing and contracting, as well as how many hours that people in jobs are working. And while those are key insights into the U.S. workforce, they could be masking a major change that is currently underway. The end of work from home. Celebrated by some, resisted by others, it is a trend that has nonetheless changed life for millions of workers, as well as the culture within countless businesses. And here to take stock of the rapid decline in flexible work arrangements and the effects of that pullback, I'm joined by Wall Street Journal On the Clock columnist Callum Borchers. Hey, Callum.
Hey there, Luke. Good to be with you.
It's our pleasure. And also with me from Washington is economist Catherine Ann Edwards, who specializes in labor markets, public policy, and inequality. Catherine, welcome to What's News. A pleasure to have you as well.
Well, howdy, and thank you for having me.
Thank you. Callum, let me start with you. I guess there's no such thing as an official end to work from home, per se, but that is essentially what we're seeing now, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's something that's a little bit disconnected from the numbers in the sense we pay close attention to a firm called Castle Systems, which tracks, you know, badge swipes into offices, and it shows that the office attendance is still markedly lower than it was pre-pandemic. But most workers are going back at least some of the time. So when we talk about the end of the work from home era, I think often what we mean is it's the end of the exclusively work from home era. There are fewer and fewer opportunities for people to work home entirely. It's 2 or 3 days in the office, and that's where the, you know, the average number of badge swipes might be around 50-55% on any given week. And we also see some big trendsetters, Luke, that are changing their tune. You know, Meta comes to mind as a big one, right? This is the parent company of Facebook, a pioneer in remote work. They've recently frozen new applications for remote work. And when Meta says we're not so into, you know, the remote work anymore, I think that really sends a signal of where we're headed.
Catherine, I assume you're seeing the same trend playing out.
Yes, I am. And I am not necessarily surprised by it, but I guess I come with my usual amount of economist skepticism about what it means and what it will accomplish. You know, the effect of work from home on productivity is always going to have this massive asterisk next to it that we couldn't really determine that during the pandemic when so many other things had changed at the same time. You don't typically tell people go work from home and, by the way, make sure your kids are there, right? Make sure that you're not allowed to leave the house. So we won't really have a clear picture of what fully remote work means from the type of aggregate economic statistics that are really divorced from individual employer preferences. Most of the time, the people who are defining productivity are also the ones determining it. That's in their right to do. It's their employees. It's their workplace. They can decide what productivity means. And maybe for them, productivity means that I see your funny face outside my desk when I walk into my office. There's nothing that fundamentally says you are more productive as a worker if you are in person. There's nothing that fundamentally says that you are less productive as a worker fundamentally if you are not in person. But there's nothing from economic research that says it has to go one way or the other. It truly depends on how these workers or really these workplace relationships are managed. And that's very company and even manager within company specific.
Catherine, just to be clear, you're getting at a huge bone of contention here between employers and employees who are both arguing we are the ones that know best how to get the job done, but there is no objective piece of evidence we can point to settle this?
There are some things that we do know about work from home. One is that it's benefited a lot of people who have struggled historically in the workplace for equality. Probably the biggest beneficiaries are workers with a disability who have seen the largest historical increase we've seen in employment among disabled workers that has been very beneficial because of working from home. We know that workers of color have also said that they greatly prefer working from home, that when you're in a predominantly white workplace and you're a worker of color, it's nicer not to have to have those office interactions that can be awkward, that can be microaggressive, and that working from home makes them feel like they are valued solely for the work that they do and not for their ability to interact with people in the office.
Callum, I'm assuming you're still hearing the opposing arguments being made within workplaces on the productivity question.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of workers feel like, look, I proved myself. I mean, I was able to keep up the pace while I was at home. I hear a lot of complaints, too, about a lack of differentiation between the different types of tasks. For example, I think a lot of workers would concede, yes, I collaborate with my peers better when we're in person. We're talking with each other. We're bouncing ideas off one another. And we've all suffered through enough, hey, you're on mutes during the Zoom calls, all right? So I think a lot of people understand that. But I also hear many, many workers, particularly white-collar workers, who say, when it comes down to just do hands to keyboard, head down, deep work, I'm better at home because I don't have as many distractions, especially now. I mean, early in the pandemic when the kids were home because schools were shut and there was nothing else to do, yeah, there were a lot of distractions in the house. But many people have pretty good home office setups these days. The kids are back in school and they really feel like I can concentrate undisturbed and do my deep work better at home than I do in the office when so-and-so is going to swing by my desk and want to chit-chat and cause a distraction.
Catherine, what do you see as being really at the core of arguments for in-person work? Putting aside productivity, is this ultimately about company culture? Could it be something as simple as, I don't know, rental expenses for office real estate?
This decision of how to kind of manage your workplace in terms of flexible arrangements, in terms of days in the office, how we do hybrid, how we do remote, is one that was forced upon employers in a way that they had no choice at the start of the pandemic. And I think one of the problems that they're facing is just how not transparent or honest it can feel from managers and from top-down employers to say, you have to come into the office without really having the decision-making to back it up.
And conversely, Catherine, I've heard from some managers who feel like they're having better luck making the back-to-office case when they are transparent. I'm thinking of a conversation I had recently with Alan Jones, who's the chief executive of an HR software company in LA called Bambi. And so they try to sell a software subscription service. And he says, we'll chronicle what's our close rate on the days that we're in the office and what's the close rate on our days when we work from home. And he says so far he's chronicled, in general, about a 30% drop on the days when people are fully remote. So he can go to his staff and say, look, it's not about principle or what you like or don't like or what my preference is as the boss. It's in the numbers. By this metric, I can demonstrate to you factually you're more productive in the building. And so at least workers may not like the decision that he makes, but it's based in fact, and there's some data there. I think, as Catherine said, a lot of managers get into trouble when they just say, here's my new edict without really explaining why or having anything to back it up.
Okay, so workers saying to their bosses, hey, show us the evidence for why you're doing what you're doing. Is that where we're headed here? Where does this all leave workers and employers?
I think one thing that we're headed toward is another round of negotiations when it comes to hybrid and work from home flexibility. I don't think it's going to be entirely dead, but I do think that many workers may have to give a little bit to get the flexibility that they want. For example, if you looked at the job openings that are posted on a big platform like LinkedIn, you know, about a year ago, 1 in 5 of those jobs posted would have been totally remote. Well, that's more like 1 in 12. I mean, that's a pretty steep decline. And within that, it's not just that a job is a job is a job. More of those jobs that are offering full remote flexibility are contract positions, right? So not full staff jobs, not with full-time benefits. And as I talk to people within LinkedIn, their belief is that some workers are going to have to say, look, if I want that work from home flexibility, I'm talking totally remote now, I might have to go the independent contractor route. And maybe that leads to a full-time job down the line, but there's going to be some bargaining on that. Or maybe it's on comp, right? Okay, it's really worth it to me to work from home, and I'm willing to yield a little bit on my compensation package.
That was Wall Street Journal On the Clock columnist Callum Borchers joining us from Boston today. Callum, thank you so much.
Glad to be with you, Luke.
And economist Catherine Ann Edwards in Washington. Catherine, thank you.
Thank you, Luke.
And finally, summer concert season is just around the corner and ticket prices are soaring. Take it from me, I am seeing Taylor Swift next week. The face value of concert tickets is up, but things are even hotter in the resale market on sites like SeatGeek, where the average ticket to see top acts has more than doubled since 2019. Industry insiders explain the higher costs by pointing to sky-high demand, added fees, and dynamic pricing, in which prices can rise as more fans scramble for seats. And WSJ reporter Rachel Wolf says those escalating costs are leaving diehard fans of A-list acts from Beyonce to BTS with some tough choices.
After not being able to go to concerts during the pandemic and just with everything now being so expensive, they want to decide how they're splurging. So a bunch of the people I spoke to are really cutting back elsewhere in order to afford to go. They're just prioritizing that splurge over basically anything else for the month, especially people who don't have kids and who can sort of afford to pay it. They're just going without elsewhere. And one person I spoke to has actually been door dashing and doing other sorts of food deliveries just to afford her BTS habit.
And that's What's News for Friday morning. We'll be back tonight with a news show. I'm Luke Vargas with the Wall Street Journal. Have a great weekend, and thanks for listening.
This episode is brought to you by Vanta. Vanta's trust management platform helps you quickly assess risk, streamline security reviews, and automate compliance for SOC 2, ISO 27001, and more. Learn how by watching Vanta's on-demand demo at vanta.com/WSJ.